This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. William Dobson is the senior supervising editor of NPR's International Desk. He's also the author of The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy, which examines the struggle between authoritarian regimes and the people who challenge them. William Dobson will be at the University of Dayton next Tuesday to speak at the UD Social Practice of Human Rights Conference. He joins us this afternoon to discuss covering international politics, economics, and culture for NPR, and what he discovered in writing his book. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off by talking about international news coverage and what is the scope, the staff size that NPR has for covering international stories?
Sure. So we have 17 international bureaus scattered across the globe. So that means having correspondents from Beijing and Beirut and Berlin to Seoul, Moscow, Nairobi, Shanghai, really, you know, in Africa, South America, the Middle East, all across the globe. And then on top of that, we expand our reach with a number of other correspondents here, a State Department correspondent in the United States, a correspondent mainly focused on international economic news, and then also some really reliable freelancers who we go to now and again for places that we can't always get to.
What are the challenges of covering international news?
Well, it's unrelenting. That's the first thing. It's you know, by its very nature, it's constantly moving. It's been, as you know, it's been a very news-rich time here. So you're both following stories that are taking place thousands of miles away, and you're also trying to, at the same time, look at how events in the U.S. Are refracted overseas as well, because the United States obviously does have an outsized place in the world, and what happens here matters there. A big emphasis for us, though, is to really try to be sure that we're looking to find stories that otherwise would not be told. You know, what's really important to us is that we are able to bring home stories that resonate, but also educate and inform.
Why is it important, Will, for people to keep up with international news as well as what's going on at home?
Well, whether you like it or not, the world is a far more interconnected place than it's really ever been before. What is happening in a place like North Korea has direct and immediate repercussions for any place in the United States or all of Asia, certainly. Events that are occurring in Europe have immediate resonance here in the United States because they affect us. We're linked together, whether it be economically, politically, or otherwise.
Now, well, your book is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. What got you started on writing that book? What led you to write this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it was something that it began as an observation that, you know, I've been involved in international news for roughly 20 years, and I began to notice, and this really is going back quite a ways now, maybe, you know, more than 15 years, I began to notice ways in which authoritarian regimes were operating differently than they had in the past, that I began to sort of see just in my own sort of daily interaction with the news and covering events that there was a greater sophistication by a number of different authoritarian regimes that were taking a posture of not trying to wall themselves off from the world, but exactly the opposite. They were really engaging the world, that they were finding ways to interact with it, but trying to do so in a way so that that interaction didn't lead to political change in their own countries. That's the real challenge, is how, if in an authoritarian regime, if one of its top goals is a combination of survival and no political change at the top, how do you accomplish that while still being a part of the United Nations, a part of the World Trade Organization, a part of international efforts, a part of the international economy, so that you don't end up having that power challenge back at home. It's a difficult tightrope to walk. And at the same time, what you saw, what I began to notice, was more sophisticated efforts to challenge them, not by some foreign power challenging necessarily, but rather domestic challenges brought on by activists, lawyers, professors, students within these countries. And so that became a very interesting question to me, and I ended up spending several years traveling from one country to the next, trying to look at how that contest was being waged internally, domestically, in these countries.
How much has technology made it tougher to be a dictator these days?
Well, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it certainly has changed the focus for a number of authoritarian regimes around the world, where they've had to become conscious of it. But you know, in the same token, it is a tool for them as well. Once upon a time, there was no device that an activist could just drop by accident at a rally and expose their entire network of supporters and collaborators and contacts. That can happen now. I mean, there's enormous burden on those who challenge these governments to conceal their own efforts, to protect their own information in a way that they would not have had to in the past, just in the same way that if an authoritarian regime moves too clumsily in trying to shut down information flows, they can have the exact opposite response, which is end up angering the population in a way that causes even a greater challenge to their rule than they previously had. So it's become ultimately sort of a tool for both sides in an ongoing game of cat and mouse.
Do you think the Chinese crackdown on the dissidents at Tiananmen Square in 1989, do you think that would have been different or had a whole different tone to it if smartphones had existed then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a really great example, because at the time, it was a relatively simple thing. Right before the authorities really moved into the square to clear out the students and the workers who were there, they essentially made everyone's screens go dark. They pulled the plug on broadcasts that were going on there in Tiananmen, which is just not possible today. Today, if you have a group of people assemble anywhere, it's going to be captured, as we know, by hundreds, if not more, smartphones. One thing that we don't really lack today that once upon a time was true is information. Even as horrific, dangerous, and deadly a conflict as we've seen in Syria has taken place over these years, we've never been at a loss for information about what was happening there. These crimes are not committed in secret. It's much, much more difficult for any authoritarian regime to work in the shadows as it once was because of that technology. And Tiananmen Square is a great example of something that would not play out the same way now.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation with Will Dobson, Senior Supervising Editor of NPR's International Desk. And Dave joins us now. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I'm thank you for having me, guys. Do you have any concerns that the United States is becoming more authoritarian, number one? Number two, NPR does have embedded correspondence sometimes in the military, and I think that tends to give a more biased view of American foreign policy. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Sure. I'll take each in turn. I mean, in terms of whether or not I'm not an expert on U.S. domestic politics, I would say this. Terms like democracy, dictatorship, authoritarianism, to some degree, I think that they're only helpful to an extent. I mean, at the end of the day, and this is true of any political system you look at, I sort of like to look at it the way that a political scientist would, which is that any system can change. And at the end of the day, what really matters the most is whether or not there are checks and balances within that system. So that can be true of, I mean, a place that I spent time in, like a place like Venezuela, which was a very established democratic system. And we saw over a period of years that collapse on itself. And now it's found itself into something very different. I mean, when I was spending time there and when I was writing about it for my book, I was looking at it as a pretty sophisticated authoritarian system. That wouldn't be true today. It has truly collapsed in a way that many people feared it might, but what you have now is a government that isn't really even going through the motions of trying to pretend to be something other than what it is. This last gubernatorial elections that they just held just a short while ago, there was just mass sort of on the equivalent of sort of ballot stuffing. There were election results that no one would believe. That wasn't true under Hugo Chavez. I argued in the book that Hugo Chavez certainly earned and warranted the description of an authoritarian leader, but he went to great pains in order to at least keep some element of competition in the system because he saw that as essential to his legitimacy. That's been stripped away in a place like Venezuela. So I think my basic point here is that all of these things are fluid. They're fluid concepts. In terms of the question of embedding, well, that's a really practical decision. In some instances, and it can vary from place to place, embedding is the only really truly safe option for a team of reporters to pursue. You have to look at those on a case-by-case basis. When you're sending, besides aid teams that may go into really hostile areas, reporters are the only people that are going to be there that are going to be unarmed and have to be, obviously. So when you do that, you go to great pains to make sure that you're telling a complete and whole story. And I take as really great evidence of that the most recent time when we worked closely on a military embed, which was Tom Bowman's reporting in Afghanistan just a short while ago. He was there in large part to really put a strong, you know, strong and pointed questions to the U.S. military about its involvement in Afghanistan. There's no better way to do that than to actually go side by side with the U.S. military there.
How many miles, Will, did you travel altogether when you were writing this book?
I think it was just close to 100,000.
Wow.
A little bit over 90,000.
So, and how long did it take you to do the research on this?
Well, yeah, I mean, it took about 3 years in total, of really intensive reporting. And I was spending time in Russia, China, Venezuela, Egypt, and Malaysia, as well as a few other places. But those five are the ones that I primarily focused on in the book itself.
How much has democracy grown in the world? How many democracies do we actually have today compared to, say, 30 or 40 years ago?
Yeah, it's a dwindling number. And that was really what was really important to me to look at is that we've seen a real sort of what some scholars refer to as a democratic recession, where the number of democracies in the world has been on a continuous slide. And I wanted, in part, to get an explanation for that, because you know, if you look at it at the same time, it wasn't the case, in my view at least, that it was necessarily a particular flaw with democracy, because at the precise moment that I was reporting out the book, we saw people taking incredible, tremendous risks in pursuit of political pluralism, in pursuit of freedom. I mean, you don't take on the enormous risks that an activist takes on in a place like Egypt or Tunisia or Syria if you don't really have a strong belief in a possibility of a better way, of a freer life. And you could see that in the words and the messages coming from the people taking those risks. So on some fundamental level, democracy hadn't lost its purchase for people. People still were clinging to that idea. But if that's true, if democracy and the sort of principles that go with it still had currency, why was it the case that we saw this slide? And that's where I really focused on the actual methods and techniques and formulas that, in essence, authoritarian regimes were refashioning dictatorship for a modern age. They were finding new ways in order to maintain and persevere at a time where it is harder for a number of the reasons we've said and some of the reasons you've suggested involving technology and elsewise. I mean, there is more of a light being shown on them than ever before, and yet they continue. And I would say this now. I mean, a lot of that reporting was really up sort of right up to 2012, so capturing the lead up to the Arab Spring and the incredibly tumultuous year that was 2011, including the mass protests that we saw in Moscow at the end of 2011, which were still sort of rank as the biggest public challenge that Vladimir Putin has faced. And I'd say since that time, what we've seen is two things. One, you have states like Venezuela, which have become much more desperate. The ability for the system to continue to function has come under serious strain. And as a result, like I said a moment ago, they're hardly the sophisticated model that they once were.
Right. You make a distinction, too, Will, between old-school dictatorships like North Korea and this more
right.
modern, subtle version.
That's right. And this is a much more they're just desperately clinging to power however they can, and they're not really taking the incredible pains that their most immediate predecessor took in order to maintain that legitimacy. And then you have others that are emboldened, far from being desperate. And that there I would put the likes of, say, a China, which is asserting itself in the world in a way that it has not really in the past. It's even going further by sort of posing as the standard bearer of international norms and or pressing its case in a much more sort of robust way in a place like the South China Sea. And that's meaningful because, in part, it's because from Beijing's point of view, they see U.S. leadership in the world receding and giving them room to operate. And Xi Jinping has been more than happy to fill that void.
Do revolutions against dictatorships, uprisings against dictatorial regimes, are they as spontaneous as they sometimes appear in media coverage?
Basically, never. I mean, the reality is that and this I think is a really very warranted critique of media around the world, not just U.S. media, but is that oftentimes we have the impression that these protests, these revolutions, have sort of sprung up overnight, that all of a sudden, spontaneously, people decided to go to the square. And if you begin to think about that critically for a little bit, you realize that's kind of a ridiculous notion. That, you know, if you were living under Mubarak for decade upon decade, it isn't the case that all of a sudden one day a million people came to the same conclusion overnight and decided to assemble. Rather, there really is painstaking work that's going on behind the scenes, that there are activists and groups that are working to try to make that moment possible. And the problem is that doesn't lend itself to a very good story. In many cases, it's very incremental work. It's tedious work. It's work that's marked more by failure than success until there is success. And then at that moment, that's when we cast our gaze, and it appears as though it just happened overnight, when in fact there was a tremendous amount of effort leading to that day, and we just weren't there paying attention at that moment in time, which really goes back to what I was saying before in terms of what we're striving with our own coverage, is to be there in those days beforehand, to be aware of the work that might be being had behind the scenes that could eventually affect that change. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. That's really not even for us to predict. But what we should be doing is being present and observing the changes that are afoot so that maybe we'd be a little bit less surprised.
Will, are dictatorships on the decline? Do you see anything positive in that area?
Well, I mean...
Or is this something we're always going to have to be concerned about?
I don't really, from my standpoint, I don't see this as being a problem that is somehow going to be eradicated. At some level, it's not a problem for the United States per se. It's something that, as I was indicating earlier, it's fluid, and it's something that really can only be changed by the people in a given place at a given time. And any victory that is achieved for people that are trying to create a more democratic system is by its very nature something that can recede. It's something that can be lost. Opportunities that are hard won sometimes are short-lived. That's just the nature. So I think this is very much sort of a story without end about the struggle for political freedom and liberty where anywhere where people assemble, where people are. Now, I will say this. I think that oftentimes there is a sense or an appearance of a system being more formidable than it really is. I mean, I just returned from a trip to Russia last week, and there talking to people, they're already very much thinking about the presidential election that's scheduled for March of next year, where it is expected that Vladimir Putin will throw his hat in the ring again, and that again he will succeed.
And Will, we're unfortunately out of time. So,
well, there'll
that
be much more
sign
to
of
say
a good conversation. Yes. Will, thank you so much for joining me today. William Dobson is the senior supervising editor of NPR's International Desk. He's also the author of The Dictator's Learning Curve: Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. He'll be speaking on the campus of the University of Dayton next Tuesday at 7 p.m., and you can find a link to more information at wvxu.org. Tomorrow, we'll have the candidates for Cincinnati mayor on the show, so email us your questions ahead of time. Send them to talk@wvxu.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.